From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made here in Rochester with the launch of a new program. It's called the Community Counseling Circle, and its mission is to make mental health services and support more accessible to communities of color. The program is run by the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition, and it's connecting local mental health providers and faith-based organizations. According to Community Counseling Circle leaders, research shows communities of color are the most under-researched, the most misdiagnosed, and the most underserved when it comes to mental health diagnosis and treatment. And the barriers are wide-ranging: cost, stigma, provider bias. But the underlying connection is structural racism. This hour, we talk about the new program, how it works, and broader issues related to accessibility of services and culturally competent care. I'd like to welcome our guests now. Reverend Phyllis Jackson is a registered nurse, a founder, and executive director of the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition. Reverend Jackson, welcome.
Thank you, Evan, for having me. I appreciate it.
Nice having you, and nice having Dr. Melanie Silas. Melanie is a professor at MCC and board member for the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition. Melanie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me.
A brief note to listeners. This is day one of our five-day spring membership campaign, and we are only in here about 15, 18 days a year, mentioning to you that when I say member-supported public radio, it's because listeners are members, and they vote with their dollars to keep us. And eventually, if they don't, then they don't. But for now, we've got a strong and growing community, and what I'm asking you to do is to join it now. Connections listeners, I'd love to grow this membership right now. You can call 454-6300, 454-6300. It's also easy to just jump online and make a contribution of support. WXXINews.org. WXXINews.org. And if you've got the WXXI app, you can pledge right there. It takes about 90 seconds or less. And because of a great, committed group of longtime members, we have something called the Member Challenge Fund. It's a bunch of members who said, hey, let's pool some money together and let's see if we can offer matches. We're going to not only support WXXI, but we will, as a team, match what people send in. So this hour, we've got matches thanks to people like Janice Metcalf, Kathy Spear, Margaret Francis, and so many more, part of the Member Challenge Fund. Thank you to them. And so any contribution you make is doubled right now. 454-6300, WXXINews.org. And again, this is just day one, but we're so thrilled that so many of you have become members of public radio. Let's talk about what the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition is and how and why it was founded. And I'm going to start with Reverend Jackson for the story there. Reverend, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much. The Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition was a coalition that started in 2012, and it kind of grew out of a vision that I had for a number of years before it was started of bringing health, looking at health promotions that were being done in churches, but I felt like we needed to embed in the churches this whole idea of tying faith and health and medicine together. And my way of thinking of doing that was that we could establish functional health ministries that could educate, train, advocate, and teach people self-efficacy, then we would be able to get a handle on health inequities as well as health disparities because people would become managers of their own health. And so in order to do that, we kind of brought some churches together and said, this is what you can do. We can help you. We can teach you. Health ministries were established. And so we had churches join us, and we have about 35 churches at this point that are part of our coalition. And what we do primarily is educate, support, and help establish functional health ministries within local congregations or wherever they may be.
And so this is lifelong work, certainly, Reverend, but so there's not an end point. But if this mission is successful, what will have changed in our community?
What will have changed is that we will have people that understand how to obtain health information, how understand that health information, know how to utilize that health information to make informed decisions about their care, also how to advocate for themselves so that when inequities happen, inequitable treatment, happens when things that are going against what is good for them, they can have the voice to stand up and say, no, that's not working for me. That's not the way it's going to happen. Know the appropriate routes and methods to take to address those inequities as they come to them, and then begin to advocate for them, not only for themselves, but also have a voice for their communities.
Dr. Silas, how do you answer the mission of the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition? How do you describe it?
Well, I think that that Reverend Phyllis did a phenomenal job of doing that. I think that as a board member, I do see it as a connecting presence with relating both spiritual wellness and physical and overall emotional wellness together. I think that sometimes when we think about the spheres of wellness, we isolate them and think that they are in silos all of their own. But as you know, and as I know, all of these things are connected. So I think that IHMC is a wonderful vehicle that connects these two areas of spirituality and church life and then with health. I think that sometimes we separate like mental health and physical health away from our spirituality, or we sometimes culturally have created a silo around spirituality, taking care of everything. But, you know, just as our physical health needs services from, you know, medical professionals, so does our mental and our emotional health. And I think that IHMC is a wonderful bridge between the two entities.
And Reverend, can we talk about the Community Counseling Circle, how this came to be?
Well, you know, when I started with, we started with IHMC and health as a spiritual matter, it was mind, body, and spirit. And so we were addressing the physiological, the body, and addressing a lot of health issues. And I have a passion about mental health because I don't, as Dr. Silas said, they're not separate, they're not siloed, they're one and the same. And so I wanted to really address mental health, which was really lacking, in especially in communities of color. And so I had a program that I was working on with some people from University of Rochester, Dr. White, Dr. Sorensen, and Jackie Dozier, Melanie, that we were doing a mental health training class. And we've been doing that in the community every year for about 6 years to teach people about mental health, the diseases, to treat stigma, so like a mental health literacy. And so I had this vision that we would get this, and we would get people trained, and we would give them information, and then we would go bring it back to the community and base it in the community. And that was my vision, is that we would, that people of color would have access within their communities to this mental health that they needed. And so that was my vision, and that was my desire. And it started with RUM, and then we wanted to take that and move it. How do we get that in the community? How do we work with faith communities? And Dr. Silas was the answer. She had a great vision of her own that, and working in mental health, and she was that catalyst to help us be able to transition it from what was in my head and her head into an actual program. And so she came forth and being on our board and asked her, can you help us do this? How does this, what does this look like? And she made that happen to a great extent.
So Dr. Silas, tell us about how that has happened. And frankly, when we talk about mental health services, you know, some people may think psychiatry, and some might think psychology, and they might think therapy, they might think, you know, sort of a range of ideas here. Hone in on what we're talking about here.
So when we talk about mental health counseling, we're really talking about talk therapy, and that really can be done by a number of professionals. So you can go to a psychologist, you can go to a psychiatrist, although psychiatrists normally dispense medicines, which is not uncommon in attaching itself to talk therapy, but that's not where we are. So talk therapy, we're using counselors and social workers within the community, and we are really providing access to a service of talk therapy and, you know, in different elements of talk therapy, maybe utilizing different strategies that will help any particular participant. So overall, so let me just give you the basis, or, you know, just a framework of the CCC program. So we wanted to definitely connect and partner with churches. So we are connected and partnered with four different churches for the particular program. And we also have about 8 to 10 counselors that we have also partnered with. And we wanted to bring the two together. We wanted churches to be the kind of like the access point, because what research says is that when we talk about access and mental health for communities of color, that access is a problem, that sometimes there is so much red tape that they can't get to mental health services or help seeking services that they might need, or if they do have access to it, you know, how do they actually get to it? So research talks about, you know, not just having the people, you know, come to counseling, but maybe having counseling come to the people. And that's what we're really trying to do. We're trying to bridge the gaps between people actually having access. So how it works is that each particular church has a coordinator, and the churches, you know, do marketing, and they, you know, talk about what the program is, and they help to disseminate the information. And it is through the church and the coordinators that they actually sign up to be partnered with an actual counselor who will do counseling services or talk therapy along with other strategies to help people deal with grief, to help them deal with depression, to help them deal with anxiety, to help them deal with relational issues, to help them deal with trauma, you know, and loss. I mean, just think about all the things that we've experienced as a community here, just in Rochester, not even, you know, nationally, but just think about all the things that we've experienced here within our own community. Like all of those things, what are people doing with those emotions? What are people doing with those experiences? And how can people be served? How can we eliminate the stigma, especially in communities of color, about talking to people outside of our normal sphere, about doing talk therapy? So, you know, the Community Counseling Circle program really tries to be a vehicle that we can say, you know what, you can have both your spirituality and you can have counseling, just like you can go to the doctor's office. But we're trying to get the actual counseling services to people. We're bringing the services where the people are.
Well, I think this is so important here, Dr. Silas, because, you know, last month on this program, I was remarking that I think therapy is so important. It has been very helpful in my life, but there have been times where even I am going, well, you know, if I find a new therapist, what if I commit to a bunch of sessions? How much am I going to pay? I'm like one of the most privileged people who has ever been born. And I am weighing, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
And so we had a conversation with Dr. Ruth Shim on this program, who's an associate dean of diverse and inclusive education and director of cultural psychiatry at the University of California, Davis. She left the American Psychiatric Association over concerns about structural racism. And what she told us on this program is that, yes, we do have an issue of stigma, especially in communities of color, and we need to address it. But the main issue is a sort of a white-dominated system that assumes it is all stigma, that the only reason that people of color don't go to therapy, don't get services, don't believe in mental health as health is because, well, they see it as a stigma. It's not because we are not reaching them. And I want to listen to some of what she said on this program.
When we think about structural racism, there are a lot of explanations for why that might be. And what psychiatrists have been taught is that there are cultural and there are biological explanations for this, like Black and Latinx people have a lot of stigma that white people don't have about accessing mental health services, or that they don't tend to have the same insight about the symptoms that they have, and so they minimize their symptoms. But the truth of the matter is, the most common reason that people don't seek mental health care in this country has to do with cost. And so when you ask Black people and ask Latinx people why didn't they get mental health services, it's actually because it's too expensive and it's difficult to access that care. That is a structural racism problem. That is a problem in the way that we have designed not only the general health care system, but the mental health care system, so that the majority of people cannot access care and cannot access services.
That's Dr. Ruth Shim. I wonder, Dr. Silas, if first you could tell us what you think about what you just heard, and then how the Community Counseling Circle is going to aim to make sure it is accessible to those who need it.
Well, I would like to add to what she's talking
sure.
about. So I do believe that finances is, and it is documented in research, that finances is a barrier for communities of color to receive counseling or to get access to counseling. That is a problem. And you're right. If you mm-hmm. as a person who you see yourself as privileged and you have mm-hmm. financial resources are double thinking or triple thinking
yep.
about whether
mm-hmm.
you want to use this $20 copay or $50 copay on this service, mm-hmm. you know, imagine the people who do not have. That's just one aspect. But let's talk a little bit, Evan, about the cultural competency,
yeah.
the cultural access, the faces and the spaces and the experiences of the counselors and the social workers that people are actually exposed to. You know, the last thing that people of color or clients of color want to endure is the same racism and stereotypes and stigma that they endure daily, on a daily basis in the counseling session. Some of my research has been specifically around not just being culturally competent, not just knowing the information, but actually doing the work, enacting the behaviors that you learn with your cultural competency, you know, knowledge. You know, there are two things that I'm trying to say at the same time. Number one, we need more counselors of color, period. You know, people want to be served by people who look like them. Representation is important. It is important for us to be able to choose a Black or Latina or a counselor who looks like us. But it's also important that if there are counselors who are of other ethnicities or nationalities, that they understand and that they understand about their own biases that they bring to the table, and that they mm-hmm. address them and make a safe space for their participants. Not just a safe space within the counseling atmosphere itself, but also making connections with the community, with the stakeholders, with the gatekeepers. Like we are not doing that. So you don't have to be Black, you don't have to be Hispanic to necessarily do good counseling with another Black or brown person, but you mm-hmm. do need to be connected to the community. You cannot foster trusting relationships if you do not have a relationship. So finances is certainly one, but cultural competence is another. Having access to counselors of color is another barrier. Understanding that education is absolutely needed, and that's a part of the counseling circle, that we are putting education along with the counseling. We have 5 webinars that we're doing every week, and it's every Wednesday through the rest of this month. We're talking about depression. We're defining what depression is. You know, we don't want to have an assumption that people know what depression is or know what anxiety is or know what grief is. Well, let's educate the community on that. When I did my own research, what I found were participants within my study talked about there's not enough education about it. You know, mm-hmm. Reverend Phyllis just talked about how over the past several years, they've been trying to educate the community. We need more education, but we also need counselors to be present within our communities. You can't invite mm-hmm. us to a space and not be connected with the community.
Absolutely.
Reverend, you want to add to that?
Yes, and that's so key. And not have cultural understanding. Where we've come from and what we're dealing with, the microaggressions that we deal with on a daily basis, add that as Black people and brown people, we're already experiencing this, and then add the COVID pandemic and all of that's been happening on top of that. But the fact of the matter is that we are relational people, most of us are, and we want relationship. And what Dr. Silas said, not having a relationship, not having a connection to the community has been a great, great barrier. And this program eliminates that. You know, one of the Pew researchers did a research study. They did question, and they sent out, and what they found on Black people talking about people of color. And, you know, 43% of those people said that they looked to religion for guidance. and 39% said that they attended religious study classes or education classes at least weekly. And so 47% said they attended church at least weekly. So you know what that says to us? That we have places that are relational. There are already established relationships within churches, within faith communities. We have established relationships. We have people that know each other. We have people that can identify with each other's culture. We know, not totally, completely, because none of us all can do that. But we have these people and these relationships that we know each other. And so what we needed, what was lacking was the other part was the education and the access. And what the community counseling circles does, it provides these things, this access, because we're in spaces where people are, where they have relationships, and our counselors are people that look like us. And so, and part of our program is absorbing some of the cost for them if they have copays and they can't afford it. Certainly cost is an issue. It's an issue for me going to counseling. And but the program does address that as well, so that we want to remove whatever barriers are there to keep people, that hinder people from getting that, the mental health help that they need. Education, access, and cost.
And Reverend, let me just press that point here. Especially in the Black community, many people may choose to seek support from a faith community before seeking a medical diagnosis if they're perhaps struggling with mental health.
Absolutely.
So that door being open and going about it the way that you, Dr. Silas, have, is potentially much more of an avenue to reach people, not only to reach people, to be where they are, but but can you also destigmatize in this way? Can you use this faith connection as a vehicle to pull down any stigma that currently exists?
Well, actually, absolutely. One of the definitions that they have come up with, the WHO and CDC now, is part of the definition of health literacy is decreasing stigma. And how do we decrease stigma? Is by helping people to understand, to get knowledge, to gain understanding through relationships and walk them through that so that they know what it really means, what it really is all about, not about what they have heard, not about what they thought or what has been passed on from generation to generation, but actual knowledge. And this is what this does. When you get knowledge and you have education and you get support in where you are, you're met where you are with someone that looks like you, and they walk you through this and they give you the education, then the stigma is decreased. There's nothing to be ashamed. We eliminate that shame. We eliminate it because we're walking and we're giving you education. And so what you thought was, let me say this, crazy is no longer. Once you understand where that came, what that means, what mental health, what depression means, what anxiety means, you know I'm not, quote, crazy, you know. And so that eliminates the stigma. And when we're doing it in faith communities and we're tying it to our faith, and we can tie it to faith, okay, then that also helps decrease the stigma.
And Dr. Silas, how many different churches and faith-based locations are you in with this program now?
We have four so far. So this is a pilot program where we are able to help approximately 30 people. And so we are under a grant right now. And so as Reverend Phyllis was saying, that there's no cost for the participants. If they have a copay or something like that and they cannot handle that copay, well, actually, we're actually not asking them for anything. The program will actually cover that. So we are making sure that the counselors get paid, because I think that that's important also. This is their living. This is how they make a living and provide for their families. You know, you cannot say we want to provide a service for the community, but then within that same community, you want to say we want your services for free. You know, this is how people live. And so we wanted to honor the counselors. We wanted to honor the participants. And so we are working with Church of Love Faith Center, New Life Fellowship, Greater Harvest Church, and Glory Health International. And each of those churches have a coordinator that is specifically for the CCC program, where participants or those who want to participate will connect with the coordinator, and the coordinator will actually get them into partnership with a counselor, and they will have up to 6 sessions of free counseling. One of the things that I just wanted to add is that the church pastors actually help to dismantle that stigma. Mm-hmm. You know, parishioners look to pastors as leaders, as, you know, as decision makers, as, you know, people who have their best, you know, heart and mind. And so as we partner with these pastors, and they're not just, you know, saying, okay, well, you know, we'll have a coordinator within our midst, but they're saying we are partnering with you in this mission of destigmatizing help seeking. You know, research says that communities of color, especially Black women, wait until they are at the end of their rope, when they are in serious crisis, before they even consider seeking help. And so we want to let people know that you don't have to wait until you're on the brink of suicide or total depression or, you know, just not being able to function. You can come and have talk therapy and talk about, mm-hmm. you know, anything that might be going on. We don't want people to wait until the last minute. And, you know, I believe that counseling actually should be a lifestyle. My training is counseling. You know, I'm a, you know, so I believe in counseling. And as a counselor, you are required to do counseling so that you understand what your participants are undergoing as they go through counseling. But I think that counseling should be a lifestyle. It should be a part of it. You know, when we talk about self-care, you know, self-care is really supposed to be something that mitigates the impact of, you know, chronic oppression and chronic stress and trauma. Well, what it does is it doesn't just stop it, but it helps to rebuild the body, right? So when people are dealing with chronic and long-term exposure of chronic oppression and trauma, which we know communities of color do, it not only impacts their mental health, but impacts their physical health. We have the highest rates of mortality, the lowest, yes. You know, rates of lifespan. Well, that is all connected. One is not disconnected from the other. And so when we're talking about seeking help and, you know, dealing with, you know, issues and trauma that people might have had, we're really dealing with the whole body. We're trying to expand the lifespan. We're trying to give quality of life to people, you know, not just say, oh, you just need to talk to somebody just to talk to somebody. But this really is a health issue.
Well, and
absolutely.
One more point.
We know that.
Yeah, go ahead.
That both, let me just say that she's talking about mortality and morbidity. Those are downstream. Those are downstream results of what happens upstream. And so if we don't address structural racism, we don't address all of these other issues that are upstream. If we address them, when she said it should be a lifestyle, if we start addressing mental health when they're young, with young people, and as they grow and it becomes a part and embedded in our communities, then we're dealing with those upstream things so that we won't get to these gross disparities in health and life, morbidities and mortality downstream. So it's an upstream attempt, and this is one way we're looking to do that is with an upstream approach.
Well, and let me ask you both one more question on the subject of stigma, because we've been talking about how to dismantle it and why this work that you're doing can be so effective, working with faith communities, sometimes working directly with pastors, setting examples, having conversations, destigmatizing. But that's after stigma already exists. And I'm curious to know where both of you see where it comes from. One study that we found indicated that 63% of Black Americans believe that a mental health condition is a sign of personal weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Where does, Reverend, let me start with you. Where do you think that comes from?
I think it comes from our history. We, going all the way back, talking about post-traumatic slave syndrome, looking all the way back into the times when we were enslaved people. Whatever else was going on, we had to be strong. In order to survive, they had to be strong. Uh-huh. In order to survive, children being taken away. In order to survive, women, husbands and wives having to be sold off or having to be subjected to the master, the wife having to do that. They had to hold those emotions in. They had to be strong in order to survive and keep moving forward. And I think that attitude has been passed on generations that, you know, we can't be weak. That is a sign of weakness. And so we have kind of incorporated that over the years, and we've passed that on. I know growing up, when I was growing up, it was, you didn't tell anybody your business. And, you know, therapists and mental health workers were white people. I didn't know of a mental health therapist, a counselor when I was growing up. But you know what? We were told in order to survive during slavery time and post-slavery, we had to be able to keep our information to ourselves because it made us vulnerable for them to know what was going on in our household. And so, yes, that's a valid point. It's something that we have inherited, but we are trying to break that chain as we help people to understand that keeping stuff doesn't fix it. Our coping mechanisms work for a while, but eventually they fail. And so, yes, we have had that, but that was something that came along that we inherited that was a result of our subjugation as Black people. Mm.
Dr. Silas, what do you think?
Yeah, I think she did it. She answered that question with much justice. I think that the labels dealing with lack of trust, especially of those outside of the community, what would they do with that information? What would they, you know, split up the family? How would they use that information against the families? You know, Black and brown communities have really had to survive by protecting the family at all costs, even if
Absolutely.
It meant at their own mental health cost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even talking about it within, you know, the family was really, it wasn't a thing. You just don't talk about those things, you know? So we've learned how to suppress and, you know, we've learned how to suppress not out of malice. I don't think that it was given to us, you know, generationally or ascribed, you know,
Absolutely not.
Quality ascribed to us as in a malicious way from generations, but it was in a protection way. You know, you don't
yes.
tell people your business. You don't,
right.
you know, you don't know what you're exposing the family to,
mm-hmm.
who's going to come,
mm-hmm.
you know, because, you know, other populations have had more power
mm-hmm.
over us, over our families and communities. You know, we just didn't have that power. So I think that Reverend Phyllis has done a phenomenal job and really just given us a brief history of how that stigma has taken place. And so we want to dismantle that. We want to say that, you know, if you are feeling like you need to seek help, then there is a safe space to do that. And counseling should be safe. And if whenever you don't feel like the person that you're having talk therapy with is safe for you, then you should honor that and then find another person. But that's
mm-hmm.
also a whole nother, you know, deal. You know, once you
yeah.
Like kind of open up the can of worms to one person and that doesn't work, it's like, do I want to do that again? We want to try to fit people with people who actually fit them, but we want to normalize this idea of talking. We want to normalize this idea of processing feelings. We want to normalize this idea of not just adults, but children having a voice and understanding that it's okay to be in touch with your feelings and to say, mm-hmm. what do I do with this, and to get support in doing that.
Talking to Dr. Melanie Silas, who's a professor at Monroe Community College and a board member for the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition, and Reverend Phyllis Jackson, who is a registered nurse, founder and executive director of the coalition. They're talking about mental health access, and the work in this community that's happening with Community Counseling Circle and more. Let's take this only break of the hour, and we're right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we talk with the remarkable Heather McGee, renowned economy expert and the author of The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. She will be a keynote speaker at MCC later this month. But first, she joins us on Connections, talking about her work and how structural racism affects all Americans. That's Tuesday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and our guests are working in this community, especially in faith communities, but all across the Rochester area to increase awareness, opportunity, training for mental health services, and access. And, you know, we just heard Dr. Silas talking about, for example, women who really reach kind of the end of their mental capacity sometimes, Black women, before they may seek care, and the goal to make sure that someone is not coming really to the end of their capacity before they get the kind of mental health services they need. Well, if our guests can figure out a way to get more young boys, especially, I will be. And in the Circle's welcome video, Dr. Kian Yame from Sankofa Family Counseling emphasizes that, quote, despite some misconceptions, counseling is not solely for women and children.
Mm-hmm.
We also serve men. It is important for men and boys to have a safe space to talk through their thoughts and feelings and to develop and strategize healthy coping skills, end quote. That's from Dr. Kianyame. This, you know, Dr. Silas, this is true. Every race, et cetera. I mean, there seems to be this. I don't know if it's like this masculinity construct that, you know, you don't show your feelings, you don't ask for help, you sure as hell don't go to therapy, and perhaps
you don't cry.
You don't cry. You don't cry. Right. So can you expand on some of what Dr. Nyame was saying there?
I think that everything that you're saying is right. And I, that quote that that Dr. Kia is really saying is that we want to dismiss this myth that, oh, talk therapy is just for women or it's just for girls. Like, you know, that is a girl thing to do or a feminine trait. Talk therapy is for everyone. Counseling is for everyone. Everyone needs a safe space. And you know, I believe that IHMC is trying to provide that expansion of the program for CCC to include a focus around men and boys. I think that it is absolutely imperative. And I think that if we only focused on women and girls, we would be doing our communities a disservice because men and boys are absolutely a vital aspect and one of the core sources within our community. We want to make sure that everyone is strong, and we want to dismantle that myth about what masculinity is and what counseling is not for men. You know, it is for men. It is for boys. I believe that we all need it. And not only do we need it individually, but we need family counseling. We need opportunities mm-hmm. for the family to do counseling together so that mm-hmm. boys and girls can hear their parents having discussions about their feelings and generational things that were passed down. You know, I mean, it is a scientific fact that we carry trauma within our DNA. And so we want to talk about the things that have been passed down generationally. If we have addictions that are passed down generationally, we need to know that. So if we know that depression is a genetic factor within our family spheres, we need to talk about that and say, you know, if you happen to feel bluesy or if you feel these kind of traits, that's actually, you know, it's a norm for our family to have that. Because it's a genetic trait of ours. So these are the things that we need to do to support each other in that. But we don't even have those conversations. So, you know, I believe that it's important for men and boys to have therapy. But I also think that it's just as important for families to have therapy together.
Mm, well said. Reverend Absolutely. Jackson, what do you think?
I absolutely agree. We just finishing up a project at Congregational Health called Flex Kids Are All Right. And it was mental health program with teens. And it was a mixture of teens, black, white, Latina. And we got from every one of them, and there were boys and girls. And what we heard very loud and clear was, we wish people and adults and everybody would stop genderizing emotions. The boys said it, the girls said it. Wish they would stop genderizing emotions. That boy and the young men were saying, boys can't cry, and if we do, we're weak, we're sissies, they were very, very explicit about how genderizing emotions has caused them to really have to try to stuff and live up to these expectations of what that looks like for boys and girls. And their take on it, these were 8th to 11th graders, is it doesn't matter what gender you are. Emotions are real and they're okay. And we deal with them. And if we don't begin to address that at an early age, we're already indoctrinating. We must break that cycle and bring some education and understanding at a young age and how we parent. And that's why parent and family counseling is so important with moms and dads and children. That we've got to go back and say, listen, we want to normalize emotions wherever they are in the family. Gender doesn't matter. Anger is anger. you know? And so we really do need to go back and begin to look at, we've got to start rebuilding this, the family structure and what that looks like and what that entails and all of that, and what that includes, including emotions, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, all of that makes up the human being. They're all pieces of ourselves, for men and for women.
Every time I hear really any story of someone from any background, of any age, who has hurt someone in another way, I do think one of the great truisms is hurt people hurt people. And
yes, they do.
You know, and I wonder how much love they feel in their own life, how you know, how much they have been supported in various ways throughout their lives. And can I ask both of you, starting with Reverend Jackson, when you meet people who do get the mental health counseling, who do get the support that maybe they haven't had, what are the changes mm-hmm. you see? What are sort of, what's the fork in the road that you see, and what are the changes you see, Reverend Jackson?
I see changes in themselves. Number one, how they see themselves. I see the evolution of self-love and self-worth and self-esteem. And then that trickles, that flows over into the relationships that they have with other people. And then it also gives them a voice to begin to advocate and encourage other people along the same way. I'll give you an example. I had she was close to 80, who came to our mental health training class and had some issues in a family that had happened over 30 years ago. And she came to the ROM class. She took the training, years training, and afterwards contacted and said, I really want to address this. And I connected it up. She got connected with a counselor, and she dealt with an issue that had been an issue in her family for 30 years. And the change was remarkable. The relationships that had been broken and so wounded they thought would never be repaired were beginning to be restored. The fabric was put back together, all of that because of counseling. After all that time, it changed the way she saw herself, eliminated. She began to deal with her own guilt, her own self-condemnation. When she got rid of all of that, she was able to see much clearer, and the relationships began to change and foster and grow. And now she's a great advocate for health with others in her congregation.
Mm. Melanie Silas, what about you?
Yes, I think that when people get the right kind of counseling, when they actually engage a counselor that can see them, you know, then they can see themselves. I think that it helps them, it empowers them to confront issues instead of run from them. I believe that it gives them a sense of peace. And I think that sometimes counseling teaches peace and teaches you how to listen to yourself, listen to that instinct. To identify where they are hurt in their bodies. Like, so sometimes you can have grief or anxiety and you can actually feel it in your body. And counseling can help you to locate where that is and to begin to speak to those places in your body for healing. I think that it gives them a love for themselves to say that they are worthy of the time that they have taken out and that they've carved to do this kind of self-care. I believe that it helps them to understand that they are not alone, that they are supported, and that they're worth it. Like, you know, that they can love themselves and they can feel normal, that they're not the first to be in this situation.
Right.
They're not the last.
Yep.
And it can normalize that and help mm-hmm. them to just like Reverend Phyllis said, see themselves differently and ultimately make better choices and not to wait until the last minute.
So,
and, you know, that is ends up being, Evan, let me say this,
yep.
when that happens, what we begin to do is address it as a public health issue. It's a public health. It begins public health. That's another domain of mental health literacy, is that it moves into the community. And that's what happens, because when people get their own voice, then and they have confidence in that voice and what they've gone through, experience, and come over, then they begin to want to be the voice for the community. And that's where we want to go.
Well, let's talk.
And then also, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'll just say this one last thing, is that it also helps for people to name their issues or name their problem or name their emotion. And sometimes that is the most debilitating thing, is that when you can't figure out, or you don't have a name or a voice or mm-hmm. any language to articulate, and that counselor can help you to articulate what you're mm-hmm. feeling and put those thoughts into words. I can name what's wrong with me. I can see, and then I can actually tackle it from there. It's not this invisible force mm-hmm. anymore. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. And Absolutely. So in our remaining minutes, let's just talk a little bit about how people can connect with these services now and into the future. I mean, this is a pilot program, as Dr. Silas mentioned, but we're wondering what's next and what that timeline might look like. So, oh, man. I know this is the hardest question to answer. Dr. Silas,
yeah,
do you want to start?
Well, I know that IHMC is working on another grant right now so that we can expand the program and to include a bigger focus on men and boys. That is probably gonna happen over the next year or so, I hope, if we get the grant. Mm-hmm. If that particular grant does not come through, then I'm sure that that we'll be looking at some other ways in which we can expand. I believe that if people want to get access to the program as it currently is, they can reach out to Church of Love, to New Life Fellowship, to Greater Harvest, and to Glory House International, and to IHMC itself. And we will get you in contact with a coordinator that will do the intake process and make sure that you get over to a counselor.
Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely.
As you said,
we're looking for funders. We're looking for streams to expand this program and reaching out and in the community. So we're significantly just rolled it out, and we have a significant number of people that are already approached. That are ready to get into the counseling. So we know that it's something that's needed. We know it's needed in our faith communities, this connection between faith and works, and the idea that faith, God works through people, places, and things. And so we're finding that people are hungry for this. They want it. And so we do hope that we will be. We're very confident as we look at all the problems that are happening in our community, as we address the issues that have happened in our own local community, the trauma, the anger, the police issues, all of those kind of things that are affecting us and people's mental health, the pandemic, that this program is absolutely needed, and that we are confident that as we will find some resources to be able to continue to expand this model. And we thank Dr. Silas so much for helping us and for bringing us this model, and based on her research and what she's done, helping us to kind of put it into perspective and put it in the model, and so that it can be replicated and we can expand it. And we believe that there are those that will see this and understand it and say, yeah, we need to do that.
And you know, and Reverend, you're working so hard to get grants, to expand this, to keep these programs growing and reaching people. But, you know, sort of to tie this back to the question of access and why care doesn't happen, does some of this just come back to the fact that in our society there's a lot of people, and we've created a society by choice through decades of economic dispossession, et cetera? There are people who simply don't have health insurance, good health care access, sometimes transportation, sometimes just means money. And is that at the root of all of this? And in other words, this will be endless work if we have this unequal of a society.
Well, we have to begin to realize, and I think one of the things that Dr. Silas mentioned before is that we've siloed healthcare. We've siloed what it means to be healthy. And so we've had those same issues with physical care. People haven't had access. It's transportation, it's cost, it's insurance and all of that. And what the result of that has been, health disparities and health inequities. And so it's the same. It's the same person that has those. We know that those physiological issues lead to mental health issues. Mental health issues can lead to physiological, and all of it leads to spiritual issues. So therefore, yes, it's absolutely true. Those barriers that have caused this downstream effect of comorbidities and mortality is the same that's happened with mental morbidity and mortality. Absolutely, no doubt. And so those are the barriers, those structural things that we have to address. And I think that programs like this help address that.
Okay, and Melanie Silas?
Well, I couldn't have said it better than Reverend Phyllis has said it there. You know, I think that it really does, you know, go beyond the finances, but finances are certainly a barrier. But, you know, we have made the world what it is, our society what it is today. And so we are just trying to be, you know, one pebble in the pond, you know, to try to help as much as we can. But we can't do that without funding. And so we would love for, you know, a number of funders to be able to help IHMC continue the mission that they're doing. They're doing, and this is just one thing that IHMC is doing. They've done, been doing so many things over the years and have so many, you know, projects and things that are touching the community. So we say keep the funding coming so that we can continue to do the work.
30 seconds, Melanie, for a listener who may be hurting, struggling, et cetera. What's the message you want to leave with people?
You are not alone. There have been people who have been where you are. We are here to help you. There is help here, and that you can reach out to us at any time. It is not over. And there is some light at the end of the tunnel, even though you may not be able to see it right now.
Absolutely.
We got you.
And I want to thank our guests, Dr. Melanie Silas, is professor at Monroe Community College and a board member for the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition. Melanie, I appreciate all of the insight and for the work. Thanks for being back with us here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Reverend Phyllis Jackson, a registered nurse, founder and executive director of the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition.
From your mouth to God's ears.
There you go, Reverend. thank you, Reverend Jackson. A great pleasure having you.
Thank you so much, Evan. Appreciate being here with you.
And from the whole team at Connections, Emma Ray Stein, Megan Mack, producer, Rob Braden, the engineer, I'm Evan Dawson. We are member-supported public radio, and that means you. And I hope you are a member. This is our spring membership campaign. Find us on your various platforms and become a member of public radio today. Talk to you tomorrow.